the last few weeks at the timeline of Jesus' resurrection. We're going to continue forward with that tonight. So, last time we were together, we were looking at the biblical accounts of the prayer in the garden and how Jesus went with his disciples to the garden as he normally did. This was something he had been doing, so it was normal routine. And then, of course, he would then take Peter, James, and John and go a little bit further. And then he would go even beyond that, and he would go for some seclusion of prayer. We looked at the accounts in regard to the prayer, and so they spent some time there. Now, you may remember one of the ways in which the Gospels give us record different information about this event, not opposing information, but supplemental. Matthew, Mark, and Luke deal with directly the part of his prayer where he asks for God to remove the cup from him. And you may remember he does that three times where he's asking God to remove that. Now, John is a little different. When you go to John 17, the prayer that John gives us. Now, I don't know if this was a prayer he had before they left for the garden or after they arrived in the garden. So I don't know if this was in that room with the Passover or later, but John's recording of that prayer of Jesus centers on what?
Unity.
Unity between him and the Father, unity among his disciples, and the unity of those who would follow later. And it's his prayer for the faith of those to continue on. I remember when Jesus warns Peter as they're going to the garden to pray, and he says, "You're going to deny me three times." What did he say to Peter? I believe it's one of the Gospels, and I think it's Luke, but it might be John, tells us that Jesus said, "I prayed for you that your faith may not fail you." Not only was what Jesus was going to endure on his mind, but you can see throughout all this time, he's not just concerned about himself, is he? But his concentration is on those that he's leaving behind. So they get to the garden, they spend that time in prayer. And if you go to Matthew 26, and let's go to verse 47. Matthew 26, and we'll back up to verse 46 for just a minute. So after he said, you know, you need to be careful that you don't fall into temptation. Then he says, verse 46, "Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." And so we have this transition. And so this is going to begin a very long night for him. From here on, he's going to endure a lot of stuff. And I can only try to sympathize. It's hard to really get into his place of what he's going to have to endure just through the night. This doesn't include what's coming tomorrow. But I do want to get around the idea. We are 12 hours approximately, give a couple hours here or there, from his crucifixion. That's how close we are. I don't know exactly. Is this 9 at night on Friday night, or is this 10, 12? I don't know exactly. At one point, we do know it's midnight. At one point, it lets us know he's right there at that twink, you know, that very late into the night period. But here they come. Now, as we're talking about this, I had showed you last week, before we get into the rest of it, I just want to think for just a minute about where he is. Now, on the screen, you can see this is a rendition of what they believe the Mount of Olives would have looked like at the time. Now, there's some opinion in this. We can't know for sure. There's no Peter, Matthew didn't draw, sketch us out something. But just from the where it is now to what we think it was, this is approximately what it would look like. And you can kind of see that if this is true, you have the city walls here, and then this path leading out and then diverging out. And then up here are three mountain peaks, and there's one more over here that are the Mount of Olives. Now, which one was Jesus on? Don't know. I doubt the topography's changed much, that I don't believe those mountains have necessarily moved. But you can see the paths moving down and then back up. Then we have this picture. This kind of gives us a modern day look at the three summits of the Mount of Olives. Now you can see there are different facilities up there. I think there may be churches on those different peaks. But one of the things I just want us to note is that no matter which of these peaks he was on, if it was one of these three, you could definitely have a very good view from up there. One of the interesting things, somebody was talking about this, and he was trying to give us a mental picture of that night. One of the things Jesus could have very well been able to see are the lanterns traveling to him. Now, I'm not saying he did, but he does say in verse 46, look, see, here they are. Now, where are they at on the path? I don't know. But one thing we remember is it's dark. They don't have street lights. You've been out in the country, right, where there's no street lights. When it gets night, it's night. I can only imagine if you grew up in a metropolitan area, if you were to go out to the country, that's a different experience. We're getting ready to go to camp in a few weeks. That's a different experience. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And so being dark like it would have been, those lanterns, had he wanted to, very well could have seen them traveling to him. Now just for a minute, you know, you try to think about what that was like. And he knows what's going to happen. There's a text we'll look at in a minute where it explicitly says he knew what was going to happen. So he's up there. They're traveling across. Verse 46 tells us, my betrayer is at hand. All right, now, what I would like to do is, again, the different accounts give us supplemental information where they don't contrast one another, but they give us, each. If we put the four Gospels together, then we get a fuller picture of that night's activity. So what I would like to do is kind of look at them and see what they bring to the narrative here. So let's get to verse 47. Let's read a little bit. So the text tells us, while he was still speaking, so at that time in verse 46, Judas was almost there. So while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, with him a great crowd of swords and clubs, and from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Why do you think the Matthew notes, or the Holy Spirit notes, swords and clubs? Why put that information there? So he notes in verse 47 that those who were coming with Judas came with swords and clubs. Why note that?
They're not coming peacefully.
They're not coming peacefully.
They're
looking for trouble, possibly, right?
Yeah, but if they're bringing clubs, it almost sounds like they're planning to beat him first.
At least to you, yeah. If we have to, we got our clubs with us, right? If you make us use them.
They may think they may need to beat the apostles to get Jesus. Mm.
Well, we know what happens later, right? Yes, ma'am.
I mean, if I knew that this man had been doing these miracles too, I'd be kind of like, well, you know, he might be trying to like bring down legions on us or something.
Well, and when we get to Luke's account, I want you to keep that in mind. So there's something interesting Luke gives us that the other ones don't. That's very fascinating in that regard, and how the soldiers and the others, what kind of mindset did they have coming? I think the other thing it does is it contrasts two different groups. You've got Jesus' group here, and then you've got these soldiers coming with Judas and these other officials, right? And there's a real stark contrast between the two, isn't there? And so he's setting the scene here. Verse 48, now the betrayer had given them a sign. It's interesting to note how Judas is now really, in the gospel writing, has now become that which had been proclaimed. He's just simply the betrayer. He doesn't call him Judas, does he? Interesting to note. The betrayer had given them a sign saying, this one I will kiss is the man. Seize him. Before I get into the interaction, again, another interesting note, the kiss. What does the kiss denote? When you go up to someone, and in our culture, we don't go up and kiss people. Like, if you go up and kiss somebody, you're in trouble, right? That's not good, unless it's your spouse. But in our custom, what might you do? You go up and you shake their hand, you might give somebody a hug. All right. Well, what does that imply?
Friendship.
And how does Jesus respond to him in verse 50? So let's read it. Verse 49, he came up to Jesus at once and said, greetings, Rabbi. That's fascinating too. And he kissed him. Jesus said to him, friend, do what you came to do. Now, I remember earlier at the supper, when Jesus identifies Judas as the betrayer, what did he say to him? Go do it quickly. And now he says, do what you have come to do. But he introduces him. Again, I think Jesus is catching him here. You're kissing me like a friend? Hey, friend. It almost makes your skin crawl just a little bit. Or does mine?
Friends like that, you don't need enemies.
Yeah. But he chooses that greeting. Now, there might be, I can't get in the mind of Judas why he did it, but it is fascinating that that was the sign he chose. Also, one other thing, the kiss is important because it does what? It identifies who Jesus is, which lets you know something, which is what? What does that imply? They didn't know who he was. Even after all this time, all the things that have happened, they still don't know for sure who he is. Now, you can go back and study the Gospels. There were several times when Jesus, because of what he was doing, a crowd got stirred up. And the text lets us know that he just kind of got away. He just walked away and went out secretly from the crowd. Now, how was he able to do that? Well, they didn't have him memorized. Now, there are a couple of things we've got to kind of get over. In our culture, we're very technology-based, right? We're a very information-based society where your picture is plastered everywhere. And we have the ability to take pictures anywhere. Everybody's walking around with a camera, a video camera in their pocket. They didn't have that. And so how would you know what he looked like if you hadn't been very close in his personal circle? What would you refer to? It's not like the old police shows where the chief's at the front, you know, and he's passing out the cards so they'd know who they're after. That's not the way it worked. And so they needed this sign. So Jesus says in verse 50, friend, do what you came to do. Then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. Now, before we go on, is that how it happened? Or is there any details that maybe the other ones give us before this event? So it's going to be a little bit tricky, but we're going to kind of move to the different Gospels, and you're going to see a couple different things, or a couple additional things that the other Gospels give us that occurred. Mark's gospel is very similar to Matthew's. There are a couple of things I'll note from it, but go to Luke. Oh, wait, not Luke. Let's go to John. I'm sorry, it's John. John's one I want to. John chapter 18. And I'm just going to note a couple of verses here. We won't read the whole thing just for time's sake. But I do encourage you to go back and read all of them. But if you go to verse 2, notice John gives us here. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also what? Knew the place. John 18, verse 2. Judas knew the place. What does that indicate to you?
That he's been there before.
Judas has been in this very garden praying with him. Or at least knew about it. Imagine he's been there and prayed with the other disciples. He knew the place. He goes on to say, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So again, just reinforcing this idea why Judas was needed by the chief priests and the elders. Well, it's because he knew Jesus. He knew what he looked like. He also knew where he would be. This also reminds us, well, we'll get there in a minute, but you notice they're in seclusion here. There's not a big crowd around him. It's just Jesus and his disciples. Okay. Then go down to verse 4. If you go to the end of verse 3, English Standard tells us instead of clubs, it says torches and weapons. So again, just that idea of those swords and clubs. They've come there with those. Then notice verse 4. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him. What's the Holy Spirit trying to tell us?
He's all-knowing.
Oh, he's all-knowing. But specifically right here. He's not surprised by any of this. That when Jesus bowed his knees and asked for this cup to be removed, he understood all that would occur. He's not praying that out of any ignorance at all. And when he told Judas earlier, go and do what you do quickly, he knew what Judas was up to. So when he saw Judas coming, was it a surprise to him? Were they in that garden and just happened to get caught there? No. When he went there, he knew what was going to happen. So he knew all that. And then the text goes on to tell us, you know, their interaction. He says, who do you seek? End of verse 4. They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. I'm assuming this is after the kiss. John doesn't note the kiss. He notes the afterwards interaction. They answered, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said to them, I am he. Another one of your I am statements in John. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, I am he, notice the reaction. This is what we were talking about earlier. What happened to the soldiers and all the other people there? They drew back and fell to the ground. So they're there with all their weapons. They've marched out as though to get a hardened Barabbas criminal, a rioter. They've come there in their full regalia to try to take him down. And what do? When they just hear him simply say, I am he.
Yeah. They drew back and fell to the ground.
You know, you can imagine what that was like. Why did they do that? Because there's some impressive warrior before them? Is that why? Why do they do it?
I think part of it, at least, I think they're just surprised that he's so straightforward and he's not trying to conceal anything.
Could be, but I think it's because he's God.
Yeah.
He's just different. This isn't some normal character. You know, I can't help but think about when we read Acts 9, Acts 22 and 26, Paul's conversion. What happened when he was confronted by Jesus on the road?
Fell to the ground.
But not just him.
Everybody else.
And they fell, the text tells us, as if they were dead. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something to be in the presence of God in a moment like this. And so they, the impression I get, at least in my mind, is they kind of stumble back. They're like, whoa. Now, I don't know. Maybe it was. They're just shocked to you so up forward. I don't know if I fully buy into that idea, but I think it is kind of interesting to note they have a physical reaction.
Well, he did perform in miracles, and I'm sure some of them knew that, and maybe they weren't expecting it to be him, actually be him, and that maybe they thought maybe he'd cast a spell or something, you know.
And that very well may have been it. Maybe it's what they've heard. Maybe it's that he didn't meet what they were expecting. Maybe this isn't the guy we thought we were going to find. I don't know. But it is. It's kind of interesting to note what they did.
Well, he did say, "I am," too, which is, you know, the name for God. I mean, so.
Yeah, that's kind of more what I was thinking.
I don't know where it is in the gospel, but Jesus said, listen, I'm giving up my life. No one takes my life.
Nobody takes it.
So when I read that, it's saying like, I'm demonstrating my power over you. Because I was a soldier in the army. You come up to your enemy, you just don't get so surprised at someone and fall down. So I take it that is Jesus is showing his power.
Well, I mean, and I guess that's why I don't, yeah. Because if I'm going, I've never done it, right? I've never been a soldier, never been a police officer. But I think if I'm packing from heat, and I'm going in somewhere, I'm ready to go, right? I'm ready to go. I'm in my stance, right? You're in that deep. You're on that defense or that offensive line. You know, you're coming up on that. You want to get up and get in hard. But they have the opposite reaction. They fall back. Let's see. So they go on, verse 7. So he asked them again, Jesus, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go. So I want to come back to that phrase. That's important. We'll note why that's important in just a minute. So it says, let these men go. And then verse 9, this was to fulfill the word that he had spoken of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one. And you can go back to his prayer and he talks about that as well. Now, if we start to compile these, let's go back to Matthew's account for just a minute. We'll come back right back to John in just a second. So, looking at this, go back to Matthew chapter 27 and go down to verse 51. Okay, so the end of verse 50, what's the last phrase there? They did what? They seized him. They grabbed him. And this is after they had fallen back and now they've gotten back their accountants back. They've grabbed him. And then what happens? Verse 51. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the high priest, the servant of the high priest, and cut off his ear. Now, it's interesting. Matthew does not tell us who it is. And that has puzzled me for years. I wonder why Matthew doesn't do that. I don't know. That's the answer. I don't know. But he doesn't tell us. He just says one of the disciples. Now, we know who it is. It's Peter. And we'll find that out in just a minute. So Peter takes out his sword and he's ready, right? He's charging. Remember what happened. They seize Jesus. Peter reacts. Now, in verse 52, Jesus responds and says, put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scripture be fulfilled that it must be so? Now, so that's Matthew. Mark is pretty much the same. So I'm not going to go there just yet. But I do want to go to Luke's account. And then we'll go to John. So Luke chapter 22. And okay, so 49. Let's go to Luke 22:49. Let's read the text here. Luke 22:49. And when those who were around him saw what would follow, well, what are they talking about? So if you go back one verse earlier, that's the kiss and Jesus' response to it. So when they saw that and they heard Jesus' response, what do they say? End of verse 49. What do they say?
Lord, shall we strike with the sword?
Lord, shall we strike with the sword? Now, I noted this last week. I don't think Peter's the only one with a sword. Okay. Notice it's we. Peter's the guy that drew the sword, at least it's noted. But shall we strike with the sword? Verse 50 tells us, then one, again, Luke doesn't record Peter's name, but one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. So Peter goes, he grabs that sword and he cuts off his ear. Now, Matthew's account simply tells us, he told Peter, put it back. But notice what 51 says of Luke 22. Luke 22, 51. Jesus said, much more forcibly, no more of this. And I'm assuming what he said in Matthew came after that. That's my assumption. No more of this. Stop it. What had they just asked in verse 49? Shall we take and fight? And then Peter goes... I imagine this happened really quickly. And then he says, no more of this. And then if I'm right, Matthew's account goes, put away your sword, for who would live by the sword shall die by it. I imagine that's probably what he said. Why does he react that way? I want you to think about that. All right, now let's go to... we'll just read 51 since we're here. So Luke 22:51. But Jesus said, no more of this. He touched his ear and healed him. Now, in my mind, I don't know why. I've always implanted the part of that verse where it says he picked his ear up and put it back on. That's not what the text actually says. He touched his ear. So I don't know if he picked that old ear up and put it back, or if he just happened to slice part of it and he's able to put it back. I don't know. I find that interesting. Yeah, maybe he just gave him a new one. I guess in my mind I'm thinking he cut part of it. Didn't cut the whole thing off or something, but he heals it. So he does that. He touched the side of his head. Think about the gentleness of that in a very... in a very intense moment, he just reaches up, touches his ear, puts it back. What does that do to all the emotions around him? What's the quickest way to dispel anger?
Kindness.
Kindness. What does Paul tell us in Romans 12?
Overcome evil with good.
Mm-hmm.
Don't avenge yourself.
Leave a place for God to do that. And he goes on to say, if we are kind when those who are mean to, or we use kindness when those who are mean to us, what does that do? Dumps coals on their heads. You want to calm a situation down, react differently. And so you have this moment. So I want to come back to this. So I want to go to John's account for just a minute, just so we get the full picture. Let's go to John 18. John 18, and let's go down to verse 10. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. Now John supplies the name of the young man, Malchus. The servant's name was Malchus. And so Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" So when you start to put all these together, you get a much fuller picture of what's going on. So why does Jesus, I know why he says put away the swords, right? Because that's not what his kingdom's about. We'll talk more about that as we move forward. So, but why does he heal this young man? Could be a lot of different reasons. It could be out of just simple kindness. Can you think of any other reasons why that might have been done?
Here comes the plan. I mean,
okay, so it stopped the situation. It changed it up pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. It had to be fulfilled what was going to happen to him. Peter couldn't stop it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, it was the servant too, so that implies that he may, or she, well, he, I guess, doesn't say, but that they may not have had a choice in the matter.
Who may not have had a choice?
The servant.
He was forced to be there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Malchus had a soul. Jesus was still trying to win souls.
Absolutely. And I think all those could be very well the reason. One other thing that I think is interesting too, I think he's saving Peter's life. What Peter did was capital punishment. He touched the servant of the high priest. Peter would have at least been in prison for this.
His ear, he could have killed him, though, because if you come that close to...
Mm-hmm. That's why he would have been...
It's almost like, hey, get away from him, but not necessarily... But he didn't. He could have killed him, probably, if he got that close to his neck and his head.
Well, think about how close he is to his head, right? He's cutting his ear.
He was trying to kill him, but he ducked.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably what happened. Maybe he's going down like this, and he skims the top. But... what Peter did was a high crime and would not have been handled very nicely. It would have not just been Jesus who would have been dealt with, but Peter, and it may have very well been that Peter was on that cross beside of Jesus.
Maybe Jesus here would have saved Peter's rear end.
That's exactly what I think it is. I think it's Jesus saving Peter. Notice what he said again in John earlier. Verse 8, I told you that I am he, John 18, 8. So, if you seek me, what?
Let them go.
Let these other ones go.
Why does he want them to go?
He wants to make sure nothing happens to them.
Okay. And out of general kindness again, he doesn't want them to be harmed. But also he has a much bigger mission for them, doesn't he? They have a lot to do. I mean, they have a big mission ahead of them on the other side of the resurrection. And he hasn't been training these men for them to die in the garden. That's not his purpose with those 12 men, 11 men now. He had bigger plans. And so... he wants them to get out of there, and so he heals Malchus' ear. He places it back. How did the apostles react to this? Go, if you will, to Mark chapter 14. Well, let's go to Matthew 27 first. Matthew 27. Verse 56. So, remember the atmosphere. What's going on? They're coming there to arrest him. They have taken Jesus by force to arrest him. They seize him. Peter reaches up. He goes, swings at the high priest's servant. His ear gets cut. Jesus, and so that's a pretty intense situation, right? Peter and I believe the other apostles were ready. Tonight's the night. We go to battle. We're going to fight our way out of this garden, and we're going to lead a revolution. That's the intensity of the moment. You have the other people. I'm sure the other soldiers were now ready. They probably there. What do you think they did when Malchus's ear got cut? You think they just stood around? You think officers would do that? Soldiers would do that? No. Their swords are out. Their clubs are ready. It's going to be battle. And then Jesus reaches up. First he says, don't do that, right? And he reaches up and he touches his ear. And the situation changes in a moment. Jesus is the master, isn't he? He's the master of the situation always. He touches his ear. He heals it. And then he says in verse 56, all this has taken place that it might be fulfilled. Then what happened? They run away. I can't imagine what that felt like for Jesus. Now, I also know, I believe, he knew that had to happen. They had to get out of there. Because that was a situation that was about to boil over. He just calmed it down. But they needed to go. But how tough was that? And this is kind of the beginning of the trouble he's going to face tonight, the horrors of the moment. In Mark's gospel, Mark 14, 51, they all run away. And just to kind of depict the urgency with which they run away, note what he says in 51, Mark 14, 51. And a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body. And they seized him. So everybody else is trying to run away. I don't know exactly. I guess it's when the other disciples are fleeing. They catch his garment. And like Joseph with Potiphar's wife, he leaves. And the text says he ran away naked. Now, my understanding is it's not total nudity, like he probably had his undergarments on and ran. But he's getting out of Dodge. Why does Luke give us that information? What's the Holy Spirit trying to depict for us? I believe it's the urgency with which they are running. They are fleeing. They are getting out of there. Let's go. Let's get out of here. Sorry, I left it on there. But so they're fleeing out, and then who's left? Jesus and a horde of soldiers and servants. And so as we move forward next week, well, not next week. Jacob will be speaking to you next week. But the week after that, we're going to come back to what happens after that. And like I said, as we get into the night, this is going to be a very long night for our Lord. He's going to endure a lot as we move forward. Any questions, comments? All right. That was the bell, so we'll be dismissed from class and be rejoined for our devotional in just a few minutes. Thank you.